Hello, and welcome to the first installment of CCR's twice-monthly podcasts on topics of the day. The Center for Constitutional Rights is dedicated to advancing and protecting the rights guaranteed by the United States Constitution and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This week, we'll be discussing one of our most important ongoing cases, CCR v. Bush, in which we argue that the warrantless domestic surveillance program conducted by the NSA since 9/11 has been a violation of criminal law and the First and Fourth Amendments. But first, a selection of news reports that have been on our radar recently. Last week, our client Meher Arar, a Canadian citizen rendered to Syria by the United States for torture and interrogation, testified before Congress, and we hope that this will be the start of a broader investigation. On October 11th, CCR filed a case against the private military contractor Blackwater for the wrongful death of innocent bystanders in Iraq. We hope that filing this case will begin to hold this corporation accountable. So far, they have operated completely outside the law. The question of government surveillance has recently been pushed into the forefront of political and legal discussion by the passage of the Protect America Act of 2007 in early August, and the ongoing debate in Congress and in the media about the so-called modernization of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1972. 2 years ago, we learned that President Bush had approved a program of warrantless spying on Americans that violates FISA and the Constitution. And this summer, Congress unforgivably extended unprecedented spying powers to the executive. The Center for Constitutional Rights has a long and successful history of challenging the legality of government surveillance programs that dates back to the Nixon era. But as technological advances make surveillance and wiretapping ever easier, and as security officials continue to press for unchecked power to cast a wider net with a tighter mesh, CCR has argued that the necessity for keeping a proper check on these programs has grown ever more urgent. It is these concerns that formed the basis of one of our most important ongoing cases, CCR v. Bush, in which we argue that the warrantless domestic surveillance program conducted by the NSA since 9/11 has been a violation of criminal law and the First and Fourth Amendments. I spoke to Shayana Katadal, CCR's senior staff attorney, on this matter. Why was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act passed in the first place, and what is it intended to do?
Sure. Well, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, was passed in the wake of Watergate. Actually, the final bill was signed into law in 1978, and it was really an immediate result of disclosures about the abuses of power that had happened under the Nixon administration, but also under the previous Democratic administration under President Johnson. The Church Committee that had investigated warrantless wiretapping generally by the president in 1974, 1975, had determined that President Johnson had used warrantless surveillance that he claimed was in the interest of national security to go after anti-war protesters, and that Nixon had used it against those folks, and that both presidents had also used it to target leaders of the civil rights movement on the theory that somehow they were tied to international communism. That was the supposed link to national security. And throughout all of this, of course, they weren't getting warrants. There was no sort of judicial check, this sort of surveillance. So FISA was intended to take away from the president any sort of absolute power to carry out warrantless surveillance in the interest of national security, and to ensure that the president had to go to a court every time he wanted authorization to do surveillance of this sort.
The Center for Constitutional Rights brought a case against the NSA in January 2006, CCR v. Bush. What was the legal basis for the case?
Well, we found out that the NSA was carrying out sort of widespread warrantless surveillance in December 2005, when the New York Times first broke the story that this was happening. And the president and the attorney general held press conferences shortly thereafter, admitting basically to the gist of what was in the Times story. And so, the reaction in our office was basically, one of shock. The president had admitted that they were carrying out surveillance of international calls, that is, calls where one end was in the U.S. and one end was outside of the U.S. And, well, a lot of attorneys in our office thought, this, you know, exactly describes an awful lot of calls that we make. So if we are calling, you know, the relatives of a Guantanamo detainee to talk about the case with them. So according to the president's definition of who the NSA is authorized to listen to, those phone calls could come under the ambit of this NSA surveillance. Similarly, we represent Mayor Arar, a Canadian citizen who was stopped at JFK while he was switching planes on his way home to Canada, interrogated for about 12 days, and then sent not to Canada, the country of his citizenship, but to Syria to be tortured because the Americans thought that that he had some link to Al-Qaeda, which was later comprehensively disproved. So when we talk to him about his civil case up in Canada, you know, those phone calls, again, are calls to somebody outside of the U.S. You know, this created an awful lot of, you know, almost a sense of panic in the office about what we should do about, you know, communicating with these clients in the future. And so one of the responses was to try to bring this lawsuit.
What effect would it have on CCR's ability to represent its clients? And what difference would it make whether there was a warrant?
Well, you know, the first question is really what impact does it have on our work? You know, first of all, for our existing clients, our existing cases, it makes it much more difficult to communicate with the clients. It means that you may have an ethical responsibility as an attorney to take countermeasures against this sort of surveillance that's sort of floating around out there in order to you know, ensure the confidentiality of at least those communications with your client that are the most sensitive. So, you know, in a lot of cases, this may involve basically flying to meet the person in person rather than discussing things over the phone or email, and that itself generates delays. You know, it can cause all sorts of practical problems. It's expensive and so forth. I think, you know, one of the more insidious problems is really that, you know, anytime you talk to someone, you know, where you don't have an existing attorney-client relationship yet, or meaning a relationship where they kind of trust you, you know, one of the first things out of your mouth has to be that, you know, they have to be cautious about what they tell you over the phone because the NSA may be listening in on it. And that's really a terrible kind of thing to have to say during these initial conversations where you're actually trying to build up a sense of trust with the client. You know, it makes you look suspect, it makes the prospective client maybe less willing to challenge things in court, and so the net effect is to make it much more difficult to challenge all the other illegal behavior. And just to be clear, the administration has said in answers to questions put forward by Congress that they are not exempting attorney-client communications from the NSA program.
And we have an attorney-client privilege in this country that, under law, is respected usually, right?
Absolutely. You know, ordinarily, in any sort of situation where a court issues a warrant, whether it's under FISA or under the Basic Wiretapping Act, there are what are called minimization procedures put in place, and these are designed, you know, in part, there are many other things that have to be minimized, but one of the most important aspects of minimization is that privileged conversations have to be protected from being recorded and, in fact, from being listened to in the first place.
Can you explain exactly how the government's NSA surveillance programs carried out since 9/11 are illegal?
Sure, it's pretty simple, really. FISA, you know, essentially says that that more or less all sort of surveillance directed at agents of a foreign power, which is defined very broadly, and which covers these kind of international calls that the NSA is listening to, that they're all subject to a warrant requirement, that you have to go to a court and get approval, either before you start the surveillance or, you know, very shortly afterwards in emergency situations. You have to get approval from a court for any sort of surveillance, whether it's, you know, listening in to phone calls or you know, tapping phone lines to intercept internet communications, emails, that sort of thing. Just to be clear, the NSA is doing both of those, according to the president. And so FISA also added some language to the other wiretapping statutes that were on the books, saying basically, look, you know, the statutes that Congress has created, the Wiretap Act for domestic electronic surveillance and FISA for foreign and national security electronic surveillance, those are the exclusive means for carrying out this kind of surveillance. So what Congress intended to do in the wake of the Watergate era was, or the Watergate scandal, was basically make sure that there were no sort of exceptions floating around out there where the president could go off on his own without any judicial supervision and listen to Americans' phone calls, whether they were international or domestic.
Well, 6 years later, Congress did pass a new law. Has the Protect America Act in any way diminished the legal basis for this case?
Well, it's not retroactive in the sense that it didn't sort of create any kind of immunity, whether from the phone companies that helped with the program or for the government officials who carried it out, for anything that's happened in the last 6 years. But going forward, it really does create something of an open season on international calls. What the Act says is that anytime you target someone who's outside of the United States, even if that person's a United States citizen, that the NSA can listen in to that phone call.
What's the current status of the CCR v. Bush case?
Sure. Well, the government has moved to dismiss it on two grounds. One, they say that we don't have standing. They say you shouldn't be any more afraid of this program than you should have been of secret surveillance orders that were issued by the FISA court. So that's part one of their strategy. Part two is basically to say, well, look, in order for us to defend the program, we would have to show you why this falls within the president's kind of core war powers. And to do that, we have to explain who we're targeting and how they sort of are people that we are, you know, sort of fighting a war against. And we can't do that without disclosing information about the program. So basically they're saying that the state secrets privilege it prevents them from successfully defending this case, and therefore the judge has to just throw it out at the outset. You know, on the other hand, we've said that they've admitted publicly everything that you need to know in order to rule that this this program violates FISA, so that we should win outright without needing any sort of discovery of secret facts. So the district court now in San Francisco is considering both of those arguments, the argument that we win and the argument that they win, right at the outset.
If the government has to go to a court, how burdensome is that really in terms of being able to effectively address security concerns?
You know, the president's first defenses of the program was that we need speed and agility to respond to the current sort of modern terrorist threat that wasn't around when Congress passed FISA in 1978. And, you know, they haven't made that argument very much lately, and the reason is that it really doesn't stand up to very much scrutiny. FISA allows for emergency wiretaps to be put in place, you know, basically the moment the Attorney General certifies that there's an emergency. And in those situations, he gets to go to the FISA court for approval retroactively. You know, he can wait for up to 72 hours and then go to the court and ask for the warrant after the fact. You know, it doesn't get much faster than retroactive approval of a warrant. And in practice, I think out of the first 19,000 applications for warrants under FISA, only 5 of them were rejected.
Defenders of the NSA surveillance methods have argued that United States civil liberties are not put at risk by either the current program under the Protect America Act or under the old program, which highlights a feeling that many people might have that, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, I'm not committing any crime, so why should I be worried?
Well, you know, we've talked a little bit about the sort of historical pattern of abuse. Anytime the president is allowed to listen to people's phone calls without judicial supervision, it's always been used to go after the president's political enemies. And we've also talked about how easy it is for the president to get approval from judges. And I guess that means that people ought to really ask themselves, why would they go around a process that's been so easy to use? And, well, I think there are really, you know, only a couple answers. One is that, you know, they may not be targeting people who have some link to terrorism. They may be doing something where, you know, they're using technology in order to basically be able to listen to every phone call and scan every email to do something, you know, sort of more akin to data mining, a lot more like the Total Information Awareness Program that John Poindexter was trying to develop for the military. And that's something I think that, you know, rightly should spook everybody out there, because they may be listening to everyone, regardless of whether you're doing anything wrong. The other, you know, sort of reason they may be going around the FISA process is that they may be trying to get the kind of surveillance that even conservative FISA court judges would never approve of, to listen to conversations between journalists and their sources, or listen to conversations between attorneys and their clients. And I think that's something that has the potential to really subvert, you know, the entire sort of check that the judicial branch is supposed to place on the executive. You know, we are sort of, I think, trapped right now in this discourse that says that, you know, anytime you're trading away civil liberties, you must be getting safer. And I think eliminating the warrant requirement is one of these areas where you become less safe and less free.
Make sure to join us for our next podcast, when we'll start a 2-part series on habeas corpus. Finally, we'd like to recommend a book by 2 of CCR's board members, Jules Lobel and David Cole. The book is called Less Safe, Less Free: Why America is Losing the War on Terror. In the book, Cole and Lobel argue that the preventive paradigm adopted by the Bush administration to fight the so-called war on terror as evidenced by the detentions in Guantanamo, illegal wiretapping, the invasion of Iraq, and the coercive use of torture, has not only eroded the rule of law and cherished freedoms, but also has made us more vulnerable to terrorist attacks. The book is published by The New Press and available at a bookstore near you.